The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place. That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
Hello and welcome to The Price of Football, the show that looks at the money behind the beautiful game, with him, Liverpool University's Kieran Maguire, and me, half a term at Reading University's Kevin Day. Hello Kieran, how are you?
I'm very good, Kevin. I didn't know you'd gone to Reading University.
Yes, I was studying archaeology at Reading University for 6 weeks and fell in love, was required to leave. And also I had to hump as I was expecting a trowel on my first day and didn't get a trowel. Although then, ironically, I became a builder and got a trowel on my first day doing that. It's questions day, Kieran. The first of which is, how much does Man United fan producer Guy regret his hilarious Carabao Cup questions now? Eh? I told him. I said, let's hope Palace don't beat Man United at Old Trafford, because it'll be payback time. Let's. Man United fans listening to this, it's because of producer Guy that you lost to Palace yesterday. He taunted me karma-wise. Before the proper questions, Kieran, we have some news stories. FIFA have been calculating how much world football has lost during the COVID crisis.
Yes, and they estimate it's probably going to cost around about a third of their normal total annual revenue. So we're talking around about £11 billion. They have decided that they're going to sort of give grants to lots of the member countries, and they've already had 150 applications for around about $1.5 million per member of FIFA. And I get a little bit twitchy about this, because my experience of observing FIFA and governance is they do have a hard job to begin with, to keep an eye on what happens to the money. And if they're having to give it out for these grants, where it's going to end up, given the behaviour of many FIFA members in the past, heaven only knows.
Well, also what I take from that is that FIFA's annual income is £33 billion.
Well, that's football's annual income. If you take a look at FIFA's accounts, they tend to be crap, 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 great. You know, they are so dependent upon the World Cup. I mean, the good news from FIFA's point of view is that they had $780 million of cash sloshing around, and I use that word sloshing advisedly, in a bank account at the end of December 2019. They had a further $3 billion of what we refer to as financial assets. So these will be sort of short-term loans to people or government bonds and that stuff. So FIFA is cash rich, so it can afford to distribute money. Where that money is going to end up, we're not sure. But FIFA estimates that Europe, UEFA, is going to take the biggest hit financially in absolute terms, in dollar terms. But it's most worried about South America, because that's going to take the biggest percentage hit, because the clubs there are so reliant upon international matches, but also selling players to Europe as a means of generating cash. And those two streams of income simply aren't taking place.
Of course, yeah. I don't think you need to use the word sloshing advisedly, Kieran. If it had been slushing, I think you probably would have to use that advisedly. But sloshing, I think you're fine with. Now, this is a slightly odd one, I think, Kieran, and I'll explain why afterwards if you don't explain in the body of your answer, of course. The Premier League say they will provide financial support to the EFL, but only if the Championship introduces a player wage cap. Now, it's only a week or so since the Premier League were asking for other conditions as well. So they seem determined not to give any money out to EFL, don't they?
Yeah, this is a strange one because the EFL have said, well, we don't want to have a begging bowl. So, i.e., we don't want money from the Premier League. But it does seem that that the government is putting pressure on the football industry to sort of help the less well off. Mm. So there is talk about a loan, either from the Premier League or perhaps guaranteed by the Premier League to the EFL. But what we are seeing, and this has always been the case when it comes to the Premier League, there's no such thing as a free lunch, so that they don't tend to spontaneously give things away. So it looks as if this could be linked, A, for the support from the EFL for the Premier League's Brexit policy,
yeah,
in terms of recruiting players from EU countries, where historically, you know, you think about our two clubs, we're not always signing internationals from Europe, but you know, you've got the likes of Max Meyer and we've seen players who weren't necessarily internationals, but who were still decent players. So those clubs will be at a significant disadvantage following Brexit if they want to recruit from Europe. And the Premier League's been looking for support to perhaps get some form of dispensation from the government. The Premier League's also looking for support, apparently, in relation to the football calendar. Now, read into that what you will, but you know, for me, that's cutting back on the Carabao Cup and certainly replays in terms of the FA Cup, trying to get support from that. And then the third one is the championship wage cap. Now, on the face of it, you'd look at that and say, well, why should clubs in the Premier League give a hoot about wages in the championship? But then you start to think about this on a slightly more insidious level. If you are an existing non-Big Six Premier League club, your ambition is to avoid relegation.
Yeah.
So if the clubs in the championship are coming up on lower wage bills, the chances are that their squads aren't perhaps as good as they could have been. So it's more likely to create yo-yo clubs between the Premier League and the championship, but also it's going to allow those non-big clubs in the Premier League to be able to poach players from the championship far easier, which again is going to reinforce the gap. So the proposal for the wage cap in the championship is £18 million. Now, that will be what we refer to as a squad salary cap. So you can play an individual player as much as you want, so long as you don't go over the squad total. But the present present average in the championship is £34 million. Now, that includes non-playing staff as well. But clearly, you know, the vast majority of money being paid by football clubs is going to players. So it's going to be a tough one, this.
But this is the bit I don't understand, Kieran, and I know that's my motto on this pod. But it comes with some risk because, you know, three of those non-Big Six clubs will be relegated this time next year. So they're in danger of cutting off their own nose to spite their face, aren't they? Or are they putting timescales on this?
No, I think this would have to be introduced for 2021-22 if it is going to come in. But the loan, I mean, the EFL's cash hole exists now. So it could be that they will say that the Premier League will say, well, we want the wage cap to come in next season. I agree with you that there are going to be potential losers. But also I anticipate that if there is this squad salary cap of £18 million, there will be caveats and loopholes for those clubs relegated from the Premier League, because clearly they're coming down on average wage bills of £100 million plus, which could, again, reinforce the yo-yo. So even if you do go down this season, you're walking into a championship with an average wage of 18 instead of 34. That's going to put you an advantage if, for example, your parachute payments are allowed to go towards wages on top of the 18. So negotiations will be taking place. I think the Premier League's probably in a slightly stronger negotiating position than the EFL, because the EFL clubs need the cash more.
Yeah. Do we know how much the Premier League are offering? Or is this just a vague?
I think the loan was in the region of 200 million.
Oh,
now,
okay.
You know, remember, it's a loan. So it's not fresh money. It's money which the Premier League will be looking to get back at some point in time. But I can't see commercial banks lending to EFL clubs at present because, as a bank manager, you'd be daft to do so.
Yeah.
The risks involved are very high.
Okay, now, to our surprise, I think, Paul Elliott has succeeded in his appeal to be granted an injunction to block the sale of Charlton Athletic. So does that make him the legal owner now?
No, the legal owner is still East Street Investments,
right,
who bought the club, I think, for £1 or £2 in January. They were initially trying to sell to this guy called Paul Elliott. He failed the owners and directors test, which, as we know, is quite a low bar. So to
some doing, yeah.
Achievement. He's now penned an open letter to fans, and he claims it was just due to an administrative issue. Now, if it was just an admin issue, given that this ban on him took place at the start of August, you would have thought that could have been sorted out very quickly. So that does seem a bit strange. I think the concern from Charlton fans' point of view is that whilst this thing is dragging through the court, they still can't sign players. The embargo they have on signing players still exists. I did a bit more digging into Paul Elliott, this Manchester-based businessman, because he was trying to take over East Street Investments via this company called Lex Dominus. He claims he's a businessman. According to the Lex Dominus background information, he's a property owner and developer. Now, you know, I've now got a large klaxon sounding in the background whenever it comes to when you see property developer and football ground mentioned in the same sentence. So I'm a bit twitchy there. He does have some other directorships of companies as well. So, again, I did a little bit of digging into the background. He's got a couple of other companies, one of which is losing money every year, and the other one has got £1 worth of assets. So it does make you feel slightly uneasy. Passing the owners and directors test should be a relatively straightforward exercise, provided you can prove that you've got funding to run a club for a couple of years, then I can't see why you should fail it. So I presume that's the reason why you failed it. So that doesn't, to me, strike me as an admin issue.
Mm. And that, as you say, that property owner and developer always just strikes a chord anyway. Just in general makes the hackles rise, doesn't it, a little bit? Apologies to any of our listeners who are property owners and developers. Well, I'm a property owner technically. But there's some prime real estate in that part of South East London as well. So that would make perfect sense. So another club to keep an eye on. Final news story. Barnsley have had talks with other EFL clubs about a move away from Oakwell. Why do they need permission from other EFL clubs, Kieran? And this is going to be difficult, isn't it, considering that the local authority owns half the stadium?
Yeah, again, we've said on many occasions, as soon as you've got separation of football ground from football club, things start to get awkward.
Yeah.
So Oakwell is 50% owned by Barnsley Metropolitan Council and 50% owned by the Crine family, who used to own the football club.
Yeah.
Barnsley Football Club are owned by a company called the BFC Investment Company, based in Hong Kong. So therefore, they own the football club, but they don't own Oakwell. They did have an option to buy 50% of Oakwell from the Crine family, but by all accounts, they hadn't even paid all of the instalments for the football club. So therefore, the Crine family turned around and said, well, if you've not paid your instalments for the football club, why should we sell you the football ground?
Cool.
So therefore, BFC Investments, they're now sort of toys out of pram. They're threatening to move Barnsley and find somewhere else to play. And the council aren't happy about that. The Crine family aren't happy about that. I don't think the EFL would be particularly happy about that. They do allow clubs on a short-term basis to play their games elsewhere, as we've seen with Harrogate playing at Doncaster, Coventry playing at Birmingham. Coventry had been playing at Northampton, remember. But you know, that's not something they want, because it creates another potential for a franchise FC, as we've seen MK Dons arise. So it's going to get messy, and I suspect lawyers will make some money from this.
How many times have we said, if we made money out of every time you said lawyers will make money out of this story, we'd be actually making money, wouldn't we? I wouldn't have to nag Guy every second day. Right, questions. We got some good questions this week. The first one comes from Nathan Lawson. Basically on the back of the exciting news that we saw fans in some stadia on Saturday. But Nathan wants to know, what effect does having no fans at matches have on merchandise sales for clubs in different leagues?
Right. I think it really does depend upon the club, because if we are looking at clubs in the lower divisions, the club store tends to be the only place that you can physically buy the products. And therefore, if matches aren't taking place, you know, you go in, you just want a match, you might want to go and buy a shirt and so on. So it will take away the impulse buys. And remember, those impulse buys also include what I think the retail industry refers to as tat. You know, you've been into your mega store, and I've been into what we've got in our place, and it's sort of the weird stuff. You know, the strange hats and the gloves and all of the absolute nonsense, which if you've just beaten Liverpool or Manchester United or somebody who you dislike, you're more inclined to buy. So I don't think that's going to take place. All clubs do have online stores as well. So I think we'll simply see a shift from online purchases, certainly as far as Leeds United are concerned. They've been having record sales of merchandise following their promotion. So that doesn't seem to have affected them. In terms of third party distributors, and here we're talking about the larger clubs, I think they will be hit, because people aren't going to, you know, JD Sports or Sports Direct or places of that nature on such a regular basis because of lockdown related issues, and the high street is hurting. Whether those people will then go and buy online, some will, some won't. So overall, I think merchandise will take a moderate hit, but not a catastrophic one.
Mm. I've heard that word tat used before by Ali, specifically in relation to my palace garden gnome, which I was very proud of.
My next door neighbour's got one as well.
A palace garden gnome?
Yeah.
A palace garden gnome? Oh, I like your next door neighbour. Yeah. Oh, great. Mine's not even allowed in the garden. It's a shame. Now, Nick Clifton. Nick, God bless him. Nick Clifton has asked a biggie. Kieran, I can only say this. It came a little bit out of left field, but I'm very pleased to ask you. Nick's question quite simply says, what percentage of owners in the EFL are wrong-uns and how many are right-uns? And there's a note from Guy, rather plaintively, which says, let's maybe answer this without naming names.
Well, what I'm going to do here, I'm going to apply what's referred to as Pareto's principle.
Oh, yeah.
Pareto's principle says that 80% of your phone calls are to 20% of your people. And the same really applies to the EFL. 80% of the bad luck stories, or the not bad luck, the bad news stories, apply to 20% of the club. So I went through my list of wrong-uns, and it's around about 20% of clubs where I do feel uneasy about certain issues to do with the owners. I've got to be honest, there are many, many fantastic owners in the EFL. You know, and here I will name names. You know, Andy Holt at Accrington, the Palioses at Tranmere, the people that own clubs such as Lincoln and Shrewsbury Town and Burton Albion, people who get the link between the club, the town, the community, and so on. So, you know, I'd say the majority of owners are actually in it for the right reasons. But around about 20% are people who I'm concerned about both their short-term and long-term motives for the club.
Yes, I'm quite pleased. I thought you were going to go higher than 20%. It's a strange reason to be optimistic that only 20% of club owners are wrong-uns. But yeah, in these difficult times, I'll take any reason for optimism Kieran. And then maybe if he emails in, we can give him individually some names.
we'll have that for our Christmas special, our wrong'un special.
Oh, that's a good idea. Like the Big Match used to have outtakes. We'll do for Christmas. We'll do, yeah. Yeah, we should do that wrong'un special. Now, Matt Lynch has asked a question. Again, this is one of the reasons I love doing this pod, because he's highlighted something that we all know about, but it's never occurred to me to ask about the finances. Matt's question is that Premier League sides tend to play their academy football games and women's games at lower league grounds. How cost effective is this for those lower league sides? Presumably they get a fee, of course, but it requires extra work. Do they do it to improve relations for future loans, or does that fee improve their books?
No, the fee certainly does improve books. The costs of putting on matches in the WSL are relatively low, and part of the reason for that is that the demographics of people who attend tend to be different than the men's game. So therefore you need fewer stewards, for example, and security based issues. So there's a rental benefit. Then you can be, then the host club, as it were, who is having the match on behalf of the Premier League or the WSL club, they'll be taking the money from the catering and things of that nature on top of that. So there is a financial benefit. The reason why the bigger clubs like their matches not to be taking place on the ground is that they don't want to upset the groundsman. If you take a look at a football pitch these days, and anybody who is a lot younger than myself and Kevin, take a look at, on YouTube at matches that took place in the 70s and 80s, and it was rutted mud a lot of the time. And what we have today is groundsmen are very protective. We are dealing with athletes who are worth tens and tens of millions of pounds. So the last thing you want is a match where the pitch isn't as good on condition because it's been used too often. Mm. Having said that, what we were starting to see last season was for a few matches, the senior club, as it were using the host, the main stadium. And the reason for that is that if you take a look at what's been happening in the WSL, we've now got Manchester United and Manchester City in the WSL. And they were, big crowds there. Everton and Liverpool were both in the WSL last season, and then you've got Arsenal and Spurs. So I think this is testament to the fact that there is a potential audience in the WSL, which could be quite significant, and therefore you don't want those matches taking place at a local, either a non-league ground or a League Two ground when you could have tens of thousands attending for some of these matches when they tend to be derbies.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
Yeah, if there are any football fans listening to this who are naive enough to think that the most important person at a football club is the manager or the owner, think again. It's the that everyone's terrified of the groundsman at every club.
Absolutely,
it's the same. It's the same at cricket clubs. You can do what you want, but don't upset the groundsman. Basically, thank you for that question, Matt. It's very interesting. Now, Peter Hurley is a Birmingham City fan. And clearly, like my mother-in-law's neighbours up there in Quinton, has a pessimistic streak. Following the sale, says Peter, of Jude Bellingham to Borussia Dortmund, combined with the current ownership and financial situation of my club, it got me wondering about the sell-on clause, which is rumoured to be 25%, which is, would be huge if it is. So if, say, Peter says Man United buy him in 2 years for £100 million, that's a cool £25 million for Birmingham City. Actually, that's quite optimistic for a Brummie. But what happens if Birmingham do a bury, says Peter, referring to type. If Birmingham do a bury, God forbid, would a Phoenix club be eligible to receive that buy-on money? Sell-on.
Right, what we are talking here is what's referred to as contingent asset. A contingent asset is defined as an asset which may or may not arise at a future date. It is dependent upon an uncertain future event. So I went and did some homework on this. Now, if Birmingham City go into administration, then the sell-on clause will be one of the assets which could be sold by the administrators.
Oh.
Now, that could be sold as part of a deal to the replacement club, in which case the new owners would benefit for it. Possibly, and you know, I think we'd have to take legal advice here, it could be sold separately. So you know, what quite often would happen is it could be that Borussia Dortmund actually, when Birmingham, you know, if Birmingham go into administration, which isn't going to happen, we all hope, they might approach the administrators and say, look, there's a 25% sell-on clause here. Tell you what, we'll give you £3 million now and call it quits.
Right.
And then it's up to the administrators whether or not to make that decision. So it could be beneficial, or it could be separately dealt with by the administrators, but it would be one of the assets of the football club should it go into administration.
Mm. Yeah, we could take legal advice, but I don't think we can afford it, can we?
No.
Unless, well, we could. I know a bloke in my local pub who's a very, very highly qualified pub lawyer. I'll ask him. Now, Joseph Garner, hello, Joseph, is in Brisbane, and he has a follow-up question to our discussion of players' wages that we had just recently in Australia. He says the A-League is struggling with attendances falling and poor TV ratings, which has led to a vastly reduced broadcast deal. What do you think, Kieran, of the A-League's financial model, and does it have an uncertain financial future? It certainly does sound like it's got an uncertain financial future.
Yeah, I mean, if you take a look at the A-League, there's not many teams in it. The average attendance is only 8,700. I think the problem that football has in Australia is that it's trying to compete in a market where you've already got somebody with a dominant position.
Yeah.
If you take a look at Aussie Rules, the average attendance there for matches is 35,000. You know, that is Australia's national sport.
Yeah.
Aussie Rules has got the fourth highest average attendances of any sporting event apparently in the world. It's
wow.
Only behind the NFL, the Premier League, and the Bundesliga, which is a hell of an achievement.
Wow. Yeah.
So you know, trying to squeeze football in to compete against that, and of course, you know, that's also going to be reflected as far as the TV deal is concerned, does give them a problem. And it's not just Aussie Rules. Australia is very keen on rugby league. So the NRL clubs, they're averaging 15,000 attending. You've got Super Rugby, which is rugby union. That's 10,500. You take that out of the sporting fan base. And Australia isn't a huge country to begin with. There's not a lot left over for football. It's simply not a sport that gets Australian fans going. You know, the standard, because of the wages, tends to be okay, but again, nothing to get overexcited about. And because the standard's not great, it means that the TV ratings aren't great, because the quality of football that you're watching isn't brilliant. And as we've experienced, and now I appreciate yesterday you wouldn't have given a hoot about the attendance at Old Trafford, but in general, watching matches in front of big crowds is a more enjoyable experience for the TV audience. Well, if you've only got three clubs with attendances of more than 10,000 in the A-League, it's not an attractive product, and that's reflected in the price.
Yeah, and before anybody tweets in, we are aware that Australia is a huge country, but Kieran was talking about population-wise, in which it's not. So Australian football having to compete in a relatively small population with those sports is always going to be difficult. Natalie Coverley, talking about broadcasting, as you just were, Natalie Coverley asks about the Premier League's rebate to broadcasters. Is it spread equally amongst all clubs, or is it pro rata, and do relegated clubs still have to pay it?
Well, I don't think that decision has been made. I know Liverpool were very keen for it to be on a fixed basis, split evenly between the 20 clubs. Other clubs will say, well, hold on, if the money is given out on a proportionate basis, surely it should be sacrificed on a proportionate basis as well. So we're waiting to see that there's been no white smoke coming out of Premier League towers. That rebate is being spread over two seasons, is my understanding, to help clubs with cash flow. But it is almost certain to impact upon parachute payments, because parachute payments themselves are a percentage of the money which goes to clubs in the Premier League. And that was part of the original deal signed between the Premier League and the EFL at a time when everybody thought that Premier League TV deals were only going to get bigger and bigger and bigger. But they do seem to have hit a ceiling. The Premier League has also just signed a new one-year deal with a Chinese company, because we were talking recently about the Chinese deal being scrapped by PPP TV. My understanding is the original deal was worth £550 million over 3 years. And it looks as if this one-year deal that the Premier League has signed with Tencent, they're being very coy. I'm hearing stories of around about £25 million for this season. You know, that's compared to 550 over 3 years. So that's, what, 175 million a year. So, you know, clubs will be taking a big hit.
Christopher James. I'm not sure if he's a Brentford fan, but he certainly wants to know about Brentford. As far as I'm aware, says Christopher, and this is, you know, to be fair, if I was a better host, I would have taken that as a clue to look this up. As far as I'm aware, says Christopher, Brentford don't have a youth system anymore. Does that saving put them in a better financial position than other clubs? It's a good question, but Brentford are run differently to other clubs anyway, aren't they?
That's right. Brentford, they did used to have a youth team, and they scrapped it a few years ago because they had some really promising young players who got snapped up by Premier League clubs. Yeah. And remember, under the Elite Player Performance Plan, suck it, kids. You know, you're just going to have to take it on the chin. As far as the Premier League are concerned, the smaller clubs get really shafted by the fixed amounts of compensation which are available. So Brentford lost a couple of really promising young players. So therefore they said, this was the idea of a guy called Robert Rowan. And I once taught Rob, and Rob, a fantastic guy. He tragically died at the age of 28. But this was his amazing scheme that they replaced it with a B team. And what their B team does, it plays a series of friendlies against really good teams in Europe. So they'll go and play Bayern Munich's under-19s, but also they'll play matches against senior clubs in London, senior non-league clubs, to give different types of experience. It's a lot cheaper than running a youth team. I know that Huddersfield have copied this scheme. Brentford are in a strong position in many regards, because clearly London's a big catchment area, and they simply acknowledge that you've got all of those big clubs in London who are getting rid of 90% plus of their academy players at the age of 18 and 19. So the B team is effectively an under 21 team. So it gives Brentford two more years to develop these players, and Brentford's ability to spot talent and develop it, I think, is second to none in the EFL. Yeah, we've seen Ollie Watkins go this summer. Neil Mopay went the previous season. Tarkowski, you know, they've had this production line of talent, and you've got to give them a huge amount of credit for the way they've done it. But from a financial perspective, it costs around about half of running a youth team.
Yeah, and of course the difficulty is for teams like Brentford trying to encourage youngsters to go there. As a, you know, Palace are now a category A academy, which kind of gives us license to be a predator as well. So, you know, as every Premier League club has got in London has got a category A academy now, it's almost impossible for a team like Brentford or Leyton Orient to attract the best youngsters. So that's a very sensible scheme. Now, our penultimate question, Kieran, comes from Steph Johnson. I say question, it's a cross between a question and a pitch. Steph says, is there any merit in the idea of the Premier League taking ownership of their own streaming rights? So they could have an app loaded onto a Fire Stick or smart TV that allowed people to subscribe to one team or to all games. Or is the money currently generated by Sky and BT just too great to take the risk?
Well, I think quite a few people already get an app on a Fire Stick from their mate Big Dave down the pub for very reasonable prices. But I don't think that's sanctioned by the Premier League. what we're looking at here is the what we would refer to as vertical integration, where the Premier League, they take control of the product and the way of getting the product to the consumers. At present, it's too high a risk because they don't have the expertise, they don't have the knowledge of the market. So I don't anticipate this being this coming through in the next round of TV, and then the Premier League turning round to Sky, of whom they're on very good terms with, by the way, and saying we're taking our ball home and we're going to try to make all the money from it. Is there an opportunity in the medium term for that to take place? I think certainly that is the case. Some clubs have already discussed it. And what would happen is the Premier League would then use the BBC, Sky, BT, they would use their expertise in production to make the shows, and the Premier League would keep all of the money from the subscriptions themselves. So it could be that in the next round of TV matches, and we're presently in year two of a 3-year deal domestically, it could be that there's going to be one package of matches which the Premier League take in house just to see is there a demand for it. And if so, the Premier League could learn their craft by having one package out of 10 or 8, so they can find out what works and what doesn't work. And then perhaps in 2025, they could then potentially take it all in-house. But, as I was saying to you earlier, they're very happy with the relationship with both Sky and BT. The quality of the broadcasting is very high. And there's only so many pundits to go round as well.
As you know, Kieran, I'm not technical, and I'll be honest with you. Every time I hear the word Fire Stick, I just think of King Louis in the Jungle Book. To be honest, I'm not 100% sure what one is, and Ali's not here at the moment, so I can't check.
It's a dongle, Kevin.
Okay. Just the glee with which you say the word dongle, you manage to make that sound like it's going to get us taken off the air. Why don't you just say dongle there? Dongle's a great word, isn't it? But let's. I kept quiet when you said take it on the chin as well, so I was very proud of myself there. So I could sense you bridling as you lured the bait in front of me. A final question comes from Jimmy Williams. Now, Jimmy Williams says, I imagine, probably correctly, Jimmy, I imagine mid-table clubs get more income when playing the big dog teams, but does it make much of a difference to smaller clubs' incomes when local rivals are in the same league? For example, says Jimmy, would Palace prefer it if Millwall, Charlton, Brighton were in the Premier League with them? To which I say, A, Jimmy, who are you calling a smaller club? And B, no, of course we wouldn't want him in the Premier League. I don't care how much financial gain you get out of it. But does Jimmy have a point? I mean, the nature of local rivalry, does that make those games more lucrative?
Well, I think a lot depends on which division you're in. Palace sell 100% of tickets for all matches. So therefore, they're not going to sell more tickets if they were playing rivals on a more regular basis. If you take a look at match day income, it's a multiple, isn't it? It's the number of people attending multiplied by the price. Now, if it was Millwall, Charlton and Brighton playing you guys, and that was replacing, with no disrespect to these clubs, Burnley, Leicester and Watford, it could be, and I don't know enough about the Palace pricing structure, that you might be able to classify those as A-class games, so therefore the non-season ticket holder people would have to pay more money. But you've got potentially a bit more income coming in. You've also got to look at things from a cost perspective. You and I both know that if there are more rival games, then there's going to be more stewarding costs and more policing costs. And those could easily outweigh the extra income, because for a club like Palace, you've got a very substantial season ticket holder base. The away tickets are going to be sold at a fixed price of £30. So therefore, we're only talking about a relatively small number of tickets being sold, where you might be able to claim an extra, you might be able to get an extra fiver per person off it. And against that, you've got to employ more stewards, and the Met will be employing more people and charging you potentially more on top of that. So I'm not convinced it would be, from a financial perspective, better off. And also, it could be that the police might insist on some form of restricted attendance and bigger gaps between home and away fans.
Well, that's interesting you say that, as I know quite a few Palace fans, and I'm sure this would be replicated across every club, that if, for example, we play you in an evening game, they're slightly reluctant to go, and they certainly wouldn't bring their kids because, as you say, the atmosphere is much more hostile. There's far more police visible, which makes some people uneasy. So there are swings and roundabouts, and certainly no disrespect to Millwall and Charlton fans, but again, they're games that some Palace fans would be probably thinking twice about going to, especially if they're taking their granny. So that's an interesting question, Jimmy. But again, smaller club, really, please. Kieran, as ever, pleasure to be in your company. So as I say to our lovely listeners, if you've got questions for us for next week or the week after, and I'm sorry, we do have a little bit of a backlog at the moment. It's just like those signs in hospital departments where it says, don't get cross if somebody goes in before you, they might be in a different department. Sometimes if your question isn't 100% topical, we might hold it over for a week or two, but we do value all your questions. But you might have to be patient before you get them asked, I'm afraid, but please keep them coming in. And it's questions@priceoffootball.com, and it's over to Kieran for his big purple stick speech.
Yeah, well, once again, folks, thanks for your reviews. I think we're up to 997 written reviews.
Wow.
on the big purple icon on Apple Podcasts. We do appreciate them. It does make a difference somehow. Myself and Kevin don't understand it, but all the money goes to producer Guy, and he uses these to buy half and half scarves at Old Trafford, being a Manchester United fan. And he's got the world's biggest collection of half and half scarves. So, you're looking after a man and the love of his life in doing so. But if you could keep them coming in, if you give us five stars, it doesn't actually matter what you write, so you can slag us off to your heart's content as long as you give us the five stars at the same time, which might seem somewhat paradoxical. And apart from that, look after yourselves, look after your loved ones, and stay safe.
Do you know what, Kieran, I hate to top the stay safe message, but I the moment I set eyes on Guy, I knew there was something about him, and now you've put your finger on it. Half and half scarf. He just looked, as soon as I saw him, he looked like a half and half scarf man. And that explains a lot, doesn't it? Bye, everybody. See you next time. Bye-bye. The Price of Football. Price of Football.